For Olmsted, the rain was particularly disheartening. It fell on ground already saturated and filled every dip in every path. Puddles became lakes. The wheels of heavily loaded wagons sank deep into the mud and left gaping lacerations, adding to the list of wounds to be filled, smoothed, and sodded. Despite the rain, he jolted around the grounds to direct planting and sodding, and every morning at dawn attended Burnham's mandatory muster of key men. The exertion and weather reversed any improvement in his health. "I took cold and was up all night with bone trouble and am living on toast and tea," he wrote on Friday, April 28th. "Nearly constant heavy rain all the day, checking our work sadly. Yet the frenzy of preparations for Monday's opening continued unabated." The deadline was immutable. Too much had been set in motion for anyone even to consider postponement. The opening ceremony was scheduled to begin, would begin, on Monday morning with a parade from the Loop to Jackson Park, led by the new President of the United States, Grover Cleveland. Train after train now entered Chicago, bringing statesmen, princes, and tycoons from all over the world. President Cleveland arrived with his vice president and a retinue of cabinet officials, senators, and military leaders, and their wives, children, and friends. On the evening of April 30th, the night before opening day, a British reporter named F. Herbert Stead visited the fairgrounds. Assigned to cover the opening ceremony, Herbert decided to scout the grounds ahead of time to get a more detailed sense of the fair's topography. It was raining hard when he exited his carriage and entered Jackson Park. Lights blazed everywhere as shawls of rain unfurled around them. The ponds that had replaced Olmsted's elegant paths shuddered under the impact of a billion falling droplets. Hundreds of empty freight cars stood black against the lights. Lumber and empty crates and the remains of workers' lunches lay everywhere. The whole scene was heartbreaking, but also perplexing. The fair's opening day celebration was set to begin the next morning, yet the grounds were clotted with litter and debris. In a state, Stead wrote, of gross incompleteness. The rain continued through the night. May to October, 1893. On opening day, 23 gleaming black carriages stood in the yellow mud of Michigan Avenue in front of the Lexington Hotel. President Cleveland boarded the 7th carriage, a landau. Burnham and Davis shared the 6th. Both men behaved, although they still had not shed their mutual distrust, nor resolved their struggle for supreme control of the fair. The Duke of Aragua, the last living descendant of Columbus, sat in the 14th carriage. The Duchess occupied the 15th with Bertha Palmer, whose diamonds radiated an almost palpable heat. Mayor Harrison took the very last carriage and drew the loudest cheers. Assorted other dignitaries filled the remaining carriages. As the procession rumbled south along Michigan Avenue toward Jackson Park, the street behind became a following sea of 200,000 Chicagoans on foot and horseback, in phaetons, victorias, and stanhopes, and packed into omnibuses and streetcars. 1,500 members of the Columbian Guard, in their new uniforms of light blue sackcloth, white gloves, and yellow-lined black capes, met the throng and cordially directed everyone to the administration building, recognizable by its lofty gold dome. The procession approached the fair from the west, through the Midway Plaisance. Just as the president's carriage turned into the Avenue of Nations, which ran the 13-block length of the Midway, the sun emerged, igniting a roar of approval from spectators as it lit the 40 concessions that lined the avenue, some the size of small towns. The procession passed the Austrian village and captive balloon park, where a hydrogen balloon tethered to the ground took visitors aloft. At the center of the Midway, the procession veered around the woefully incomplete Ferris wheel, which Burnham eyed with displeasure. It was a half moon of steel encased in a skyscraper of wooden falsework. When President Cleveland's carriage came to Saul Bloom's Algerian village at the Muslim core of the Midway, Bloom gave a nod, and the women of the village dropped their veils. Bloom swore it was a customary gesture of respect, but of course with Bloom, one could never be sure. At last the carriages entered Jackson Park. There would be miracles at the fair. The chocolate Venus de Milo would not melt. The 22,000-pound cheese in the Wisconsin Pavilion would not mold. But the greatest miracle was the transformation of the grounds during the long, soggy night that had preceded Cleveland's arrival. When Herbert Stead returned the next morning, a plain of wind-rippled water still covered portions of the park, but the empty boxcars and packing debris were gone. 10,000 men working through the night had touched up the paint and staff and planted pansies and laid sod as 1,000 scrub women washed, waxed, and polished the floors of the great buildings. As the morning advanced, the sun emerged more fully. In the bright, rain-scrubbed air, those portions of the landscape not still submerged looked cheerful, trim, and neat. At 11 o'clock, President Cleveland ascended the stairs to the speaker's platform, erected outside at the east end of the administration building. Nearby stood a table draped in an American flag, on top of which lay a blue and red velvet pillow supporting a telegraph key made of gold. Every bit of terrace, lawn, and railing in the court of honor was occupied. The men in black and gray, many of the women in gowns of extravagant hues, violet, scarlet, emerald, and wearing hats with ribbons, sprigs, and feathers. A tall man in a huge white hat and a white buckskin coat, heavily trimmed in silver, stood a full head above the men around him. Buffalo Bill. Women watched him. Sunlight fell between tufts of fast shredding cloud and lit the white panamas that flecked the audience. At precisely 12:08, Cleveland touched the gold key. A roar radiated outward as successive strata of the crowd learned the key had been pressed. Workmen on rooftops immediately signaled to piers stationed throughout the park and to sailors aboard the warship Michigan anchored in the lake. The key closed an electric circuit, which activated the electro-automatic engine stop and starter attached to the giant 3,000-horsepower Alice steam engine at Machinery Hall. The starter's silver-plated gong rang, a sprocket turned, a valve opened, and the engine whooshed to life on exquisitely machined shafts and bearings. Immediately, 30 other engines in the building began to thrum. At the fair's waterworks, 3 huge Worthington pumps began stretching their shafts and pistons like praying mantises shaking off the cold. Millions of gallons of water began surging through the fair's mains. Engines everywhere took steam until the ground trembled. An American flag, the size of a mainsail, unfurled from the tallest flagpole in the court of honor, and immediately 2 more like-sized flags tumbled from flanking poles, one representing Spain, the other Columbus. Water, pressurized by the Worthington pumps, exploded from the McMonnies fountain and soared 100 feet into the sky, casting a sheet rainbow across the sun and driving visitors to raise their umbrellas against the spray. Banners and flags and gonfalons suddenly bellied from every cornice. A huge red banner unscrolled along the full length of the Machinery Hall, and the canvas slipped from Big Mary's gold-leaf shoulders. 200 white doves leapt for the sky. The guns of the Michigan fired, steam whistles shrieked. Spontaneously, the throng began to sing My Country, 'Tis of Thee, which many thought of as the national anthem, although no song had yet received that designation. As the crowd thundered, a man eased up beside a thin, pale woman with a bent neck. In the next instant, Jane Addams realized her purse was gone. The great fair had begun. Although Burnham recognized that much work lay ahead, that Olmsted had to redouble his efforts and Ferris needed to finish that damned wheel, the success of the exposition now seemed assured. Congratulations arrived by telegraph and post. A friend told Burnham, "The scene burst on me with the beauty of a full-blown rose." The official history of the fair estimated that 250,000 people packed Jackson Park on opening day. 2 other estimates put the total at 500,000 and 620,000. By day's end, there was every indication that Chicago's fair would become the most heavily attended entertainment in the history of the world. This optimism lasted all of 24 hours. On Tuesday, May 2nd, only 10,000 people came to Jackson Park, a rate of attendance that, if continued, would guarantee the fair a place in history as one of the greatest failures of all time. All hope that this was merely an anomaly disappeared the next day when the forces that had been battering the nation's economy erupted in a panic on Wall Street that caused stock prices to plummet. And this was only the beginning. On the night of Thursday, May 5th, officials of the National Cordage Company, a trust that controlled 80% of America's rope production, placed itself in receivership. Next, Chicago's Chemical National Bank ceased operation, a closure that seemed particularly ominous to fair officials because Chemical alone had won congressional approval to open a branch at the World's Fair, in no less central a location than the administration building. 3 days later, another large Chicago bank failed, and soon after that, a third, the Evanston National Bank in Burnham's Town. Dozens of other failures occurred around the country. People who otherwise might have traveled to Chicago to see the fair now stayed home. The terrifying economy was discouraging enough, but so too were reports of the unfinished character of the fair. If people had only one chance to go, they wanted to do it when all the exhibits were in place and every attraction was in operation, especially the Ferris wheel, said to be a marvel of engineering that would make the Eiffel Tower seem like a child's sculpture, provided it ever actually worked and did not collapse in the first brisk wind. First and foremost, Burnham knew, the fair had to be finished, and he issued stern directives to Olmsted and Ferris and to every contractor still at work. But in the meantime, lures had to be cast to encourage people to shed their fears of financial ruin and come to Chicago. He created the new post of Director of Functions and assigned Frank Millett to the job, giving him wide latitude to do what he could to boost attendance. Millett orchestrated fireworks shows and parades. He set aside special days to honor individual states and nations and to fete distinct groups of workers, including cobblers, millers, confectioners, and stenographers. Attendance began to increase, but not by much. Burnham hoped for an early cure to the nation's financial malaise, but the economy did not oblige. More banks failed, layoffs increased, industrial production sagged, strikes grew more violent. On June 5th, worried depositors staged runs on 8 Chicago banks. Burnham's own firm saw the flow of new commissions come to a halt. A less hospitable time to hold a World's Fair was difficult to imagine. The thought that worse might lie ahead occurred to no one. The first guests began arriving at Holmes' World's Fair Hotel, though not in the volume he and every other Southside hotelier had expected. Even though the rooms on Holmes' second and third floor were largely empty, when male visitors asked about accommodations, Holmes told them with a look of sincere regret that he had no vacancies and kindly referred them to other hotels nearby. His guest rooms began to fill with women, most quite young and apparently unused to living alone. Holmes found them intoxicating. Minnie Williams' continual presence became increasingly awkward. With the arrival of each dewy new guest, she became more jealous, more inclined to stay close to him. Her jealousy did not particularly annoy him, it simply became inconvenient. Minnie was an asset now, an acquisition, to be warehoused until needed, like cocooned prey. Holmes checked newspaper advertisements for a rental flat far enough from his building to make impromptu visits unlikely. He found a place on the north side at 1220 Wrightwood Avenue, a dozen or so blocks west of Lincoln Park near Halsted. The flat occupied the top floor of a large private house owned by a man named John Oker, whose daughters managed its rental. They first advertised the flat in April 1893. Holmes went alone to examine the apartment and met John Oker. He introduced himself as Henry Gordon and told Oker he was in the real estate business. Oker was delighted when Henry Gordon said he would take the apartment, even more delighted when Gordon paid him $40 cash in advance. Gordon told Oker he and his wife would arrive in a few weeks. Holmes explained the move to Minnie as a long overdue necessity. Now that they were married, they needed a bigger, nicer place than what they currently occupied in the castle. Soon the building would be bustling with visitors to the fair. Even without the guests, however, it was no place to raise a family. The idea of a large, sunny flat did appeal to Minnie. Truth was, the castle could be gloomy, was always gloomy, and Minnie wanted everything as perfect as possible for Anna's visit. She was a bit perplexed, however, as to why Harry would choose a place so far away on the north side, when there were so many lovely homes in Englewood. She reasoned, perhaps, that he did not want to pay the exorbitant rents that everyone was charging now that the World's Fair was underway. Patrick Prendergast believed his appointment as Corporation Counsel was about to occur. He wanted to be ready, and began making plans for how to staff his office once the appointment came through. On May 9, 1893, he got out another of his postcards and addressed it to a man named W.F. Cooling in the Stadtzeitung building. Prendergast lectured Cooling on the fact that Jesus was the ultimate legal authority, then gave him the good news. "I am candidate for Corporation Counsel," he wrote. "If I become Corporation Counsel, you shall be my assistant." Despite its incomplete exhibits, rutted paths, and stretches of unplanted ground, the exposition revealed to its early visitors a vision of what a city could be, and ought to be. The black city to the north lay steeped in smoke and garbage. But here in the white city of the fair, visitors found clean public bathrooms, pure water, an ambulance service, electric streetlights, and a sewage processing system that yielded acres of manure for farmers. There was daycare for the children of visitors, and much fun was made of the fact that when you left your child at the children's building, you received a claim check in return. Chicago's small but vocal censorians feared that impoverished parents would turn the building into a depository for unwanted children. Only one child, poor Charlie Johnson, was ever thus abandoned, and not a single child was lost, although anxiety invested the closing moments of each day. Within the fair's buildings, visitors encountered devices and concepts new to them and to the world. They heard live music played by an orchestra in New York and transmitted to the fair by long-distance telephone. They saw the first moving pictures on Edison's kinetoscope and watched stunned as lightning chattered from Nikola Tesla's body. They sampled a new, oddly flavored gum called Juicy Fruit and caramel-coated popcorn called Cracker Jack. A new cereal, Shredded Wheat, seemed unlikely to succeed. Shredded doormat, some called it. The fair was so big, so beyond grasp, that the Colombian guards found themselves hammered with questions. It was a disease, rhetorical smallpox, and every visitor exhibited it in some degree. The guards answered the same questions over and over, and the questions came fast, often with an accusatory edge. Some questions were just odd. "In which building is the Pope?" one woman asked. She was overheard by writer Teresa Dean, who wrote a daily column from the fair. "The Pope is not here, madam," the guard said. "Where is he?" "In Italy, Europe, madam." The woman frowned. "Which way is that?" Convinced now that the woman was joking, the guard cheerfully quipped, "3 blocks under the lagoon." She said, "How do I get there?" The skies cleared and stayed clear. Roadways dried, and newly opened flowers perfumed the air. Exhibitors gradually completed their installations, and electricians removed the last misconnects from the elaborate circuits that linked the fair's nearly 200,000 incandescent bulbs. Although interior exhibits were compelling, the earliest visitors to Jackson Park saw immediately that the fair's greatest power lay in the strange gravity of the buildings themselves. The Court of Honor produced an effect of majesty and beauty that was far greater than even the dream conjured in the Rookery Library. Some visitors found themselves so moved by the Court of Honor that immediately upon entering they began to weep. No single element accounted for this phenomenon. Each building was huge to begin with, but the impression of mass was amplified by the fact that all the buildings were neoclassical in design, all had cornices set at the same height, all had been painted the same soft white, and all were so shockingly, beautifully unlike anything the majority of visitors ever had seen in their own dusty hometowns. The lamps that laced every building and walkway produced the most elaborate demonstration of electric illumination ever attempted, and the first large-scale test of alternating current. The fair alone consumed 3 times as much electricity as the entire city of Chicago. These were important engineering milestones, but what visitors adored was the sheer beauty of seeing so many lights ignited in one place at one time. Every building, including the manufacturer's building, was outlined in white bulbs. Giant searchlights, the largest ever made and said to be visible 60 miles away, had been mounted on the manufacturer's roof and swept the grounds and surrounding neighborhoods. For many visitors, these nightly illuminations were their first encounter with electricity. Hilda Sott, a girl newly arrived from Poland, went to the fair with her father. As the light was fading in the sky, millions of lights were suddenly flashed on all at one time, she recalled years later. Having seen nothing but kerosene lamps for illumination, this was like getting a sudden vision of heaven. Her father told her the lights were activated by electric switches. Without matches? She asked. At night, the lights and the infilling darkness served to mask the exposition's many flaws. Among them, wrote John Ingalls in Cosmopolitan, the unspeakable debris of innumerable luncheons, and to create for a few hours the perfect city of Daniel Burnham's dreams. Night, Ingalls wrote, is the magician of the fair. The early visitors returned to their homes and reported to friends and family that the fair, though incomplete, was far grander and more powerful than they had been led to expect. Montgomery Schuyler, the leading architectural critic of Burnham's day, wrote, "It was a common remark among visitors who saw the fair for the first time that nothing they had read or seen pictured had given them an idea of it or prepared them for what they saw." Reporters from far-flung cities wired the same observation back to their editors, and stories of delight and awe began to percolate through the most remote towns. In fields, dells, and hollows, families terrified by what they read in the papers each day about the collapsing national economy, nonetheless now began to think about Chicago. The trip would be expensive, but it was starting to look more and more worthwhile, even necessary. If only Mr. Ferris would get busy and finish that big wheel. And so it began. A waitress disappeared from Holmes' restaurant, where his guests ate their meals. One day she was at work, the next gone, with no clear explanation for her abrupt departure. Holmes seemed as stumped as anyone. A stenographer named Jenny Thompson disappeared, as did a woman named Evelyn Stewart, who either worked for Holmes or merely stayed in his hotel as a guest. A male physician who for a time had rented an office in the castle and who had befriended Holmes, they were seen together often, also had decamped, with no word to anyone. Within the hotel, chemical odors ebbed and flowed like an atmospheric tide. Some days the halls were suffused with a caustic scent, as of a cleanser applied too liberally. Other days with a silvery medicinal odor, as if a dentist were at work somewhere in the building, easing a customer into a deep sleep. There seemed to be a problem with the gas lines that fed the building, for periodically the scent of uncombusted gas permeated the halls. There were inquiries from family and friends. As always, Holmes was sympathetic and helpful. The police still did not become involved. Apparently there was too much else for them to do, as wealthy visitors and foreign dignitaries began arriving in ever greater numbers, shadowed by a swarm of pickpockets, thugs, and petty swindlers. Holmes did not kill face to face as Jack the Ripper had done, gorging himself on warmth and viscera, but he did like proximity. He liked being near enough to hear the approach of death and the rising panic of his victims. This was when his quest for possession entered its most satisfying phase. The vault deadened most of the cries and pounding, but not all. When the hotel was full of guests, he settled for more silent means. He filled a room with gas and let the guest expire in her sleep, or crept in with his passkey and pressed a chloroform-soaked rag to her face. The choice was his, a measure of his power. No matter what the approach, the act always left him in possession of a fresh supply of material, which he could then explore at will. The subsequent articulation by his very talented friend Chappelle constituted the final phase of acquisition, the triumphal phase, though he used Chappelle's services only sparingly. He disposed of other spent material in his kiln, or in pits filled with quicklime. He dared not keep Chappelle's frames for too long at a time. Early on, he had made it a rule not to retain trophies. The possession he craved was a transient thing, like possessing the scent of a fresh-cut hyacinth. Once the scent was gone, only another acquisition could restore it. But Holmes' arrogance, his sense of exemption, was growing, and one day soon, in the midst of his most ambitious acquisition, he would break his rule against trophies, a fatal mistake. In the first week of June, 1893, Ferris's men began prying the last timbers and planks from the falsework that had encased and supported the big wheel during its assembly. The topmost rim arced through the sky at a height of about 25 stories, higher than the highest occupied floor of Burnham's Masonic Temple, the city's tallest skyscraper. None of the 36 cars had been hung. They stood on the ground like the coaches of a derailed train, but the wheel itself was ready for its first rotation. Standing by itself, unbraced, Ferris's wheel looked dangerously fragile. On Thursday, June 8th, Luther Rice signaled the firemen at the big steam boiler 700 feet away on Lexington Avenue outside the Midway to build steam and fill the 10-inch underground mains. Once the boilers reached suitable pressure, Rice nodded to an engineer in the pit under the wheel, and steam whooshed into the pistons of its twin 1,000-horsepower engines. The drive sprockets turned smoothly and quietly. Rice ordered the engine stopped. Next, workers attached the 10-ton chain to the sprockets and to a receiving sprocket at the wheel. Rice sent a telegram to Ferris at his office in the Hamilton Building in Pittsburgh. "Engines have steam on and are working satisfactorily. Sprocket chain connected up and are ready to turn wheel." Ferris was unable to go to Chicago himself, but sent his partner W.F. Gronow to supervise the first turn. In the early morning of Friday, June 9th, as his train passed through the south side, Gronow saw how the great wheel towered over everything in its vicinity, just as Eiffel's creation did in Paris. The exclamations of fellow passengers as to the wheel's size and apparent fragility filled him with a mixture of pride and anxiety. Ferris, himself fed up with the construction delays and Burnham's pestering, had told Gronow to turn the wheel or tear it off the tower. Last-minute adjustments and inspections took up most of Friday, but just before dusk, Rice told Gronow that everything appeared to be ready. "I did not trust myself to speak," Gronow said, "so merely nodded to start." He was anxious to see if the wheel worked, but at the same time would gladly have assented to postpone the trial. Nothing remained but to admit steam and see what happened. Ferris's pretty wife Margaret stood nearby, flushed with excitement. Gronow believed she was experiencing the same magnitude of mental strain as he. "Suddenly I was aroused from these thoughts by a most horrible noise," he said. "A growl tore through the sky and caused everyone in the vicinity, the Algerians of Bloom's Village, the Egyptians and Persians, and every visitor within 100 yards, to halt and stare at the wheel. Looking up, Gronow said, "I saw the wheel move slowly. What can be the matter? What is this horrible noise?" Gronow ran to Rice, who stood in the engine pit monitoring pressures and the play of shafts and shunts. Gronow expected to see Rice hurriedly trying to shut down the engine, but Rice looked unconcerned. Rice explained that he had merely tested the wheel's braking system, which consisted of a band of steel wrapped around the axle. The test alone had caused the wheel to move 1/8 of its circumference. The noise, Rice said, was only the sound of rust being scraped off the band. The engineer in the pit released the brake and engaged the drive gears. The sprockets began to turn, the chain to advance. As the wheel began to turn, loose nuts and bolts and a couple of wrenches rained from its hub and spokes. The wheel had consumed 28,416 pounds of bolts in its assembly. Someone was bound to forget something. Unmindful of this steel downpour, the villagers cheered and began dancing on the platforms. Some played instruments. The workmen who had risked their lives building the wheel now risked them again and climbed aboard the moving frame. No carriages were as yet placed in position, Gronow said, but this did not deter the men, for they clambered among the spokes and sat upon the crown of the wheel as easy as I am sitting in this chair. The wheel needed 20 minutes for a single revolution. Only when it had completed its first full turn did Gronau feel the test had been successful, at which point he said, "I could have yelled out loud for joy." Mrs. Ferris shook his hand. The crowd cheered. Rice telegraphed Ferris, who had been waiting all day for word of the test, his anxiety rising with each hour. The wheel had worked, but Ferris, Gronau, and Rice all knew that far more important tests lay ahead. Beginning that Saturday, workers would begin hanging cars, thus placing upon the wheel its first serious stresses. Each of the 36 cars weighed 13 tons, for a total of just under 1,000,000 pounds. And that did not include the 200,000 pounds of additional live load that would be added as passengers filled the cars. Anna Williams, Nanny, arrived from Midlothian, Texas in mid-June 1893. Texas had been hot and dusty. Chicago was cool and smoky, full of trains and noise. The sisters hugged tearfully and congratulated each other on how fine they looked, and Minnie introduced her husband, Henry Gordon, Harry. He was shorter than Minnie's letters had led Nanny to expect, and not as handsome, but there was something about him that even Minnie's glowing letters had not captured. He exuded warmth and charm. His warmth and smile and obvious affection for Minnie caused Nanny's suspicions quickly to recede. He did seem to be in love with her. He was cordial and tireless in his efforts to please her, and indeed to please Nanny as well. Without even thinking about it, she began calling him Brother Harry. First, Minnie and Harry took her on a tour of Chicago. The city's great buildings and lavish homes awed her, but its smoke and darkness and the ever-present scent of rotting garbage repulsed her. Holmes took the sisters to the Union Stockyard, where a tour guide led them into the heart of the slaughter. They watched as hog after hog was upended and whisked screaming down the cable into the butchering chambers below, where men with blood-caked knives expertly cut their throats. Holmes was unmoved. Minnie and Nanny were horrified, but also strangely thrilled by the efficiency of the carnage. The yards embodied everything Nanny had heard about Chicago and its irresistible, even savage, drive toward wealth and power. The Great Fair came next. They went to it almost daily, 2 weeks being widely considered the minimum needed to cover the fair adequately, and Harry promised to bring them back on July 4th for a fireworks display that everyone expected would be the greatest the city had ever witnessed. Brother Harry seemed delighted with Nanny and invited her to stay for the summer. Flattered, she wrote home to request that her big trunk be shipped to the Wrightwood address. Clearly, she had hoped something like this would happen, for she had packed the trunk already. Holmes' assistant, Benjamin Petizel, also went to the fair. He bought a souvenir for his son Howard, a tin man mounted on a spinning top. It quickly became the boy's favorite possession. As Ferris's men became accustomed to handling the big cars, the process of attaching them to the wheel accelerated. By Sunday evening, June 11th, 6 cars had been hung, an average of 2 a day since the first turn of the wheel. Now it was time for the first test with passengers, and the weather could not have been better. The sun was gold, the sky a darkling blue in the east. Mrs. Ferris insisted on being aboard for the first ride, despite Gronau's attempts to dissuade her. Gronau inspected the wheel to make sure the car would swing without obstruction. The engineer in the pit started the engines and rotated the wheel to bring the test car to one of the platforms. "I did not enter the carriage with the easiest feeling at heart," Gronau said. "I felt squeamish, yet I could not refuse to take the trip, so I put on a bold face and walked into the car." Luther Rice joined them, as did 2 draftsmen and the city of Chicago's former bridge engineer, W.C. Hughes. His wife and daughter also stepped aboard. The car swung gently as the passengers took positions within the car. Glass had not yet been installed in its generous windows, nor had the iron grill that would cover the glass. As soon as the last passenger had entered, Rice casually nodded to the engineer, and the wheel began to move. Instinctively, everyone reached for posts and sills to keep themselves steady. As the wheel turned, the car pivoted on the trunnions that both connected it to the frame and kept it level. Owing to our car not having made a trip, Gronau said. The trunnions stuck slightly in their bearings, and a crunching noise resulted, which in the condition of our nerves was not pleasant to hear. The car traveled a bit higher, then unexpectedly stopped, raising the question of how everyone aboard would get down if the wheel could not be restarted. Rice and Gronau stepped to the unglazed windows to investigate. They looked down over the sill and discovered the problem. The fast-growing crowd of spectators, emboldened by seeing passengers in the first car, had leapt into the next car, ignoring shouts to stay back. Fearful that someone would be hurt or killed, the engineer had stopped the wheel and allowed the passengers to board. Gronau estimated that 100 people now occupied the car below. No one sought to kick them out. The wheel again began to move. When the car reached its highest point, 264 feet above the ground, Mrs. Ferris climbed onto a chair and cheered, raising a roar in the following car and on the ground. Soon, however, the passengers became silent. The novelty of the sensation wore off, and the true power of the experience became apparent. It was a most beautiful sight one obtains in the descent of the car, for then the whole fairgrounds is laid before you, Gronau said. The entire park came into view as an intricate landscape of color, texture, and motion. Lapis lagoons, electric launches trailing veils of diamonds, carmine blossoms winking from bulrush and flag. The sight is so inspiring that all conversation stopped, and all were lost in admiration of this grand sight, the equal of it I have never seen, and I doubt very much if I shall again. This reverie was broken as more bolts and nuts bounded down the superstructure onto the car's roof. Despite his misgivings, Olmsted left the completion of the exposition landscape in the hands of Ulrich and Codman, and took up a schedule of work and travel that was extreme even by his own punishing standards. He traveled through 16 states, and by mid-June was at Biltmore, Vanderbilt's North Carolina estate. Along the way, in rail cars, stations, and hotels, he solicited the views of strangers about the fair while keeping his own identity a secret. The fair's lackluster attendance troubled him and perplexed him. He asked fellow travelers if they had visited the fair yet, and if so, what they had thought of it. But he was especially interested in the opinions of people who had not yet gone. What had they heard? Did they plan to go? What was holding them back? Everywhere there is growing interest in the exposition, he told Burnham, in a June 20th letter from Biltmore. Everywhere I have found indications that people are planning to go to it. First-hand accounts of the fair were sparking heightened interest. Clergymen who had seen it were working the fair into sermons and lectures. He was delighted to find that what visitors liked best were not the exhibits, but the buildings, waterways, and scenery, and that the fair had surprised them. People who have gone to the fair have, in the main, found more than the newspapers had led them to expect. He concluded, "There is a rising tidal wave of enthusiasm over the land." For all Burnham's obsession with detail and control, one event at the fair escaped his attention. On June 17th, a small fire occurred in the cold storage building, a castle-like structure at the southwest corner of the grounds, built by Hercules Ironworks. Its function was to produce ice, store the perishable goods of exhibitors and restaurants, and operate an ice rink for visitors wishing to experience the novelty of skating in July. The building was a private venture. Burnham had nothing to do with its construction beyond approving its design. Oddly enough, its architect was named Frank P. Burnham, no relation. The fire broke out in the cupola at the top of the central tower, but was controlled quickly and caused only $100 in damage. Even so, the fire prompted insurance underwriters to take a closer look at the building, and what they saw frightened them. A key element of the design had never been installed. 7 insurers canceled their policies. Fire Marshal Edward W. Murphy, acting as chief of the World's Fair Fire Department, told a committee of underwriters, "That building gives us more trouble than any structure on the grounds. It's a miserable fire trap and will go up in smoke before long." No one told Burnham about the fire. No one told him of the cancellations. And no one told him of Murphy's forecast. And suddenly they began to come. The enthusiasm Olmsted had identified during his travels, though still far from constituting a tidal wave, at last seemed to begin propelling visitors to Jackson Park. By the end of June, paid attendance at the exposition had more than doubled, with average daily paid attendance for the month rising to 89,170 from May's dismal 37,501. It was still far below the 200,000 daily visitors the fair's planners originally had dreamed of, but the trend was encouraging. From Englewood to the Loop, hotels at last began to fill. One of the delights of the fair was never knowing who might turn up beside you at the Chocolate Venus de Milo, or who might sit at the table next to yours at the Great White Horse Inn, a reproduction of the public house described by Dickens in the Pickwick Papers, or who might suddenly clutch your arm aboard the Ferris wheel as your car began its ascent. Archduke Ferdinand, described by an escort as being half-boar, half-tightwad, roamed the grounds incognito, but much preferred the vice districts of Chicago. Indians who had once used hatchets to bear the skulls of white men drifted over from Buffalo Bill's compound, as did Annie Oakley and assorted Cossacks, Hussars, Lancers, and members of the U.S. 6th Cavalry on temporary furlough to become actors in Colonel Cody's show. Chief Standing Bear rode the Ferris wheel in full ceremonial headdress, his 200 feathers unruffled. Other Indians rode the enameled wooden horses of the Midway Carousel. There was Paderewski, Houdini, Tesla, Edison, Joplin, Darrow, a Princeton professor named Woodrow Wilson, and a sweet old lady in black summer silk flowered with forget-me-not blue named Susan B. Anthony. Burnham met Teddy Roosevelt for lunch. For years after the fair, Burnham used the exclamation, "Bully." No one saw Twain. He came to Chicago to see the fair, but got sick and spent 11 days in his hotel room, then left without ever seeing the White City, of all people. Chance encounters led to magic. Frank Haven Hall, superintendent of the Illinois Institution for the Education of the Blind, unveiled a new device that made plates for printing books in Braille. Previously, Hall had invented a machine capable of typing in Braille, the Hall Braille Writer, which he never patented because he felt profit should not sully the cause of serving the blind. As he stood by his newest machine, a blind girl and her escort approached him. Upon learning that Hall was the man who had invented the typewriter she used so often, the girl put her arms around his neck and gave him a huge hug and kiss. Forever afterward, whenever Hall told this story of how he met Helen Keller, tears would fill his eyes. The morning of July 4th, 1893, broke gray and squally. The weather threatened to dull the elaborate fireworks display that Frank Millet had planned as a further boost for the exposition's attendance, which, despite steady week-to-week increases, still lagged expectations. The sun emerged late in the morning, though squalls continued to sweep Jackson Park through much of the day. By late afternoon, a soft gold light bathed the Court of Honor, and storm clouds walled the northern sky. The storms came no closer. The crowds built quickly. Holmes, Minnie, and Nanny found themselves locked within an immense throng of humid men and women. At 9 o'clock, rockets began arcing over the lakeshore. Men with flares raced along the beach, lighting mortars, as other men aboard barges set off large rotating flares and hurled bombs into the lake, causing the water to explode in extravagant geysers of red, white, and blue. Bombs and rockets followed in intensifying numbers until the climax of the show, when an elaborate wire network erected at the festival hall on the lakeshore abruptly flared into a giant explosive portrait of George Washington. The crowd cheered. Everyone began moving at the same time, and soon a great black glacier was headed toward the exits and the stations of the Alley L and Illinois Central. Holmes and the Williams sisters waited hours for their turn to board one of the northbound trains, but the wait did nothing to dampen their spirits. That night, the Oker family heard joking and laughing coming from the upstairs flat at 1220 Wrightwood. There was good reason for the merriment within. Holmes had further sweetened the night with an astonishingly generous offer to Minnie and Nanny. Before bed, Nanny wrote home to her aunt in Texas to tell her the excellent news. "Sister, Brother Harry, and myself will go to Milwaukee tomorrow, and will go to Old Orchard Beach, Maine, by way of the St. Lawrence River. We'll visit 2 weeks in Maine, then on to New York. Brother Harry thinks I am talented. He wants me to look around about studying art. Then we will sail for Germany by way of London and Paris. If I like it, I will stay and study art. Brother Harry says you need never trouble any more about me, financially or otherwise. He and sister will see to me. Write me right away, she added, and address to Chicago, and the letter will be forwarded to me. She said nothing about her trunk, which was still in Midlothian awaiting shipment to Chicago. She would have to get along without it for now. Once it arrived, she could arrange by telegraph to have it forwarded as well, perhaps to Maine or New York, so that she could have all her things in hand for the voyage to Europe. Nanny went to bed that night, with her heart still racing from the excitement of the fair and Holmes' surprise. The next morning promised to be pleasant as well, for Holmes had announced he would take Nanny, just her, to Inglewood for a brief tour of his World's Fair Hotel. He had to attend to a few last-minute business matters before the departure for Milwaukee. In the meantime, Minnie would ready the Wrightwood flat for whatever tenant happened to rent it next. At the fairgrounds later that night, the ticket men counted their sales and found that for that single day, July 4th, paid attendance had totaled 283,273, far greater than the entire first week of the fair. It was the first clear evidence that Chicago might have created something extraordinary after all, and renewed Burnham's hopes that the fair at last would achieve the level of attendance he had hoped for. But the next day, only 79,034 paying visitors came to see the fair. 3 days later, the number sagged to 44,573. The bankers carrying the fair's debt grew anxious. They were pressuring the exposition's directors to appoint a retrenchment committee, empowered not just to seek out ways of reducing the fair's expenses, but to execute whatever cost-saving measures it deemed necessary, including layoffs and the elimination of departments and committees. Burnham knew that placing the future of the fair in the hands of bankers would mean its certain failure. The only way to ease the pressure was to boost the total of paid admissions to far higher levels. Estimates held that to avoid financial failure, a humiliation for Chicago's prideful leading men who counted themselves lords of the dollar, the fair would have to sell a minimum of 100,000 tickets a day for the rest of its run. To even have a hope of achieving this, the railroads would have to reduce their fares, and Frank Millet would have to intensify his efforts to attract people from all corners of the country. With the nation's economic depression growing ever more profound, it seemed an impossibility. And then, things got worse. Holmes knew that most, if not all, of his hotel guests would be at the fair. He showed Nanny the drugstore, restaurant, and barbershop, and took her up to the roof to give her a broader view of Inglewood and the pretty, tree-shaded neighborhood that surrounded his corner. He ended the tour at his office, where he offered Nanny a seat and excused himself. He picked up a sheaf of papers and began reading. Distractedly, he asked Nanny if she would mind going into the adjacent room, the walk-in vault, to retrieve for him a document he had left inside. Cheerfully, she complied. Holmes followed quietly. At first, it seemed as though the door had closed by accident. The room was utterly without light. Nanny pounded on the door and called for Harry. She listened, then pounded again. She was not frightened, just embarrassed. She did not like the darkness, which was more complete than anything she had ever experienced. Far darker, certainly, than any moonless night in Texas. She rapped the door with her knuckles and listened again. The air grew stale. Holmes listened. He sat peacefully in a chair, by the wall that separated his office and the vault. Time passed. It was really very peaceful. A soft breeze drifted through the room, cross-ventilation being one of the benefits of a corner office. The breeze, still cool, carried the morning scent of prairie grasses and moist soil. Nanny removed her shoe and beat the heel against the door. The room was growing warmer. Sweat filmed her face and arms. She guessed that Harry, unaware of her plight, had gone elsewhere in the building. That would explain why he had still not come, despite her pounding. Perhaps he'd gone to check on something in the shops below. As she considered this, she became a bit frightened. The room had grown substantially warmer. Catching a clean breath was difficult. She hammered the door again, and now also the wall between the vault and Harry's breeze-filled office. The panic came, as it always did. Holmes had to concentrate to hear the sobs from within. The airtight fittings, the iron walls, and the mineral wool insulation deadened most of the sound. But he had found, with experience, that if he listened at the gas pipe, he heard everything much more clearly. This was the time he most craved. It brought him a period of sexual release that seemed to last for hours, even though, in fact, the screams and pleading faded rather quickly. He filled the vault with gas, just to be sure. Holmes returned to the Wrightwood apartment and told Minnie to get ready. Nanny was waiting for them at the castle. He held Minnie and kissed her, and told her how lucky he was, and how much he liked her sister. During the train ride to Englewood, he seemed well rested and at peace, as if he had just ridden his bicycle for miles and miles. 2 days later, on July 7th, the Ochre family received a letter from Henry Gordon, stating that he no longer needed the apartment. The letter came as a surprise. The Ochres believed Gordon and the two sisters still occupied the flat. Laura Ochre went upstairs to check. She knocked, heard nothing, then entered. "I do not know how they got out of the house," she said, "but there were evidences of hasty packing, a few books and odds and ends being left lying about. If there had been any writing in the books, all traces were removed, for the fly leaves had been torn out." Also on July 7th, the Wells Fargo agent in Midlothian, Texas, loaded a large trunk into the baggage car of a northbound train. The trunk was addressed to a Miss Nanny Williams, care of H. Gordon, 1220 Wrightwood Avenue, Chicago. The trunk reached the city several days later. A Wells Fargo drayman tried to deliver it to the Wrightwood address, but could not locate anyone named Williams or Gordon. He returned the trunk to the Wells Fargo office. No one came to claim it. Holmes called upon an Englewood resident named Cephas Humphrey, who owned his own team in dray and made a living transporting furniture, crates, and other large objects from place to place. Holmes asked him to pick up a box and a trunk. "I want you to come after the stuff about dark," Holmes said, "as I do not care to have the neighbors see it go away." Humphrey showed up as requested. Holmes led him into the castle and upstairs to a windowless room with a heavy door. "It was an awful-looking place," Humphrey said. "There were no windows in it at all, and only a heavy door opening into it. It made my flesh creep to go in there. I felt as if something was wrong. But Mr. Holmes did not give me much time to think about that." The box was a long rectangle made of wood, roughly the dimensions of a coffin. Humphrey carried it down first. Out on the sidewalk, he stood it on end. Holmes, watching from above, rapped hard on the window and called down, "Don't do that! Lay it down flat!" Humphrey did so, then walked back upstairs to retrieve the trunk. It was heavy, but its weight gave him no trouble. Holmes instructed him to take the long box to the Union Depot and told him where on the platform to place it. Apparently, Holmes had made prior arrangements with an express agent to pick up the box and load it on a train. He did not disclose its destination. As for the trunk, Humphrey could not recall where he took it, but later evidence suggests he took it to the home of Charles Chappelle, near Cook County Hospital. Soon afterward, Holmes brought an unexpected but welcome gift to the family of his assistant, Benjamin Petizel. He gave Petizel's wife, Carrie, a collection of dresses, several pairs of shoes, and some hats that had belonged to his cousin, a Miss Minnie Williams, who had gotten married and moved east, and no longer needed her old things. Holmes also surprised his caretaker, Pat Quinlan, with a gift, two sturdy trunks, each bearing the initials M.R.W. Burnham's work did not cease. The pace at his office did not slow. The fair buildings were complete, and all the exhibits were in place. But just as surely as silver tarnishes, the fair became subject to the inevitable forces of degradation and decline, and tragedy. On Monday, July 10th, shortly after 1 o'clock, smoke began to rise from the cupola of the cold storage tower, where the fire of June 17th had also taken light. The tower was made of wood and housed a large iron smokestack which vented three boilers located in the main building below. Paradoxically, heat was required to produce cold. The stack rose to a point 30 inches short of the top of the tower, where an additional iron assembly called a thimble was to have been placed to extend the stack so that it cleared the top completely. The thimble was a crucial part of architect Frank Burnham's design, meant to shield the surrounding wood walls from the superheated gases exiting the stack. For some reason, however, the contractor had not installed it. The building was like a house whose chimney ended not above the roof, but inside the attic. The first alarm reached the fire department at 1:32 p.m. Engines thundered to the building. 20 firemen, led by Captain James Fitzpatrick, entered the main structure and climbed to its roof. From there, they made their way to the tower and climbed stairs another 70 feet to the tower's exterior balcony. Using ropes, they hauled up a line of hose and a 25-foot ladder. They secured the hose firmly to the tower. Fitzpatrick and his men didn't realize it, but the fire at the top of the tower had set a lethal trap. Fragments of burning debris had fallen into the space between the iron stack and the inner walls of the tower made of smooth white pine. These flaming brands ignited a fire, which in those narrow confines soon depleted the available air and extinguished its own flames, leaving in their place a superheated plasma that needed only a fresh supply of oxygen to become explosive. As the firemen on the tower balcony concentrated on the fire above them, a small plume of white smoke appeared at their feet. The fire department rang a second alarm at 1:41 p.m. and activated the big siren at the exposition's machinery hall. Thousands of visitors now moved toward the smoke and packed the lawns and paths surrounding the building. Some brought lunch. Burnham came, as did Davis. The Colombian Guard arrived in force to clear the way for additional engines and ladder wagons. Riders on the Ferris wheel got the clearest, most horrific view of what happened next. Never, the fire department reported, was so terrible a tragedy witnessed by such a sea of agonized faces. Suddenly, flames erupted from the tower, at a point about 50 feet below Fitzpatrick and his men. Fresh air rushed into the tower. An explosion followed. To the firemen, according to the department's official report, it appeared as though the gaseous contents of the air shaft surrounding the smokestack had become ignited, and the entire interior of the tower at once became a seething furnace. Fireman John Davis was standing on the balcony with Captain Fitzpatrick and the other men. "I saw there was only one chance, and I made up my mind to take it," Davis said. "I made a leap for the hose and had the good luck to catch it." The rest of the boys seemed transfixed with horror and unable to move. Davis and one other man rode the hose to the ground. The firemen still on the balcony knew their situation was deadly and began to tell each other goodbye. Witnesses watched them hug and shake hands. Captain Fitzpatrick grabbed a rope and swung down through the fire to the main roof below, where he lay with a fractured leg and internal injuries, half his huge mustache burned away. Other men jumped to their deaths, in some cases penetrating the main roof. Fire Marshal Murphy and two other firemen on the ground climbed a ladder to retrieve Fitzpatrick. They lowered him by rope to colleagues waiting below. He was still alive, but fading. In all, the blaze killed 12 firemen and 3 workers. Fitzpatrick died at 9 o'clock that night. The next day, attendance exceeded 100,000. The still smoking rubble of the cold storage building had proved irresistible. The coroner immediately convened an inquest, during which a jury heard testimony from Daniel Burnham, Frank Burnham, officials of Hercules Ironworks, and various firemen. Daniel Burnham testified he had not known of the previous fire or the omitted thimble, and claimed that since the building was a private concession, he had no authority over its construction beyond approving its design. On Tuesday, July 18th, the jury charged him, Fire Marshal Murphy, and 2 Hercules officers with criminal negligence and referred the charges to a grand jury. Burnham was stunned, but kept his silence. Under customary procedures, he and the others would have been placed under arrest pending bail, but in this instance, even the coroner's office seemed taken aback. The sheriff made no move to arrest the director of works. Burnham posted bond the next morning. With the stink of charred wood still heavy in the air, Burnham closed the roof walks of the transportation and manufacturers' buildings and the balconies and upper galleries of the administration building, fearing that a fire in the buildings or among their exhibits could start a panic and cause a tragedy of even greater magnitude. As if things could not get any blacker, on the same day that the coroner's jury ordered Burnham's arrest, July 18th, the directors of the exposition bowed to bank pressure and voted to establish a retrenchment committee with nearly unrestricted powers to cut costs throughout the fair and appointed 3 cold-eyed men to staff it. It was clear, at least to Burnham, that the last thing the fair needed right now, as he and Millett continued their fight to boost the rate of paid admissions, a campaign with its own necessary costs, was to have a troika of penny pinchers sitting in judgment on every new expense. Millett had some extraordinary ideas for events in August, including an elaborate midway ball during which fair officials, including Burnham, would dance with Dahomey women and Algerian belly dancers. That the committee would view the expense of this ball and other of Millett's events as frivolous seemed certain. Yet Burnham knew that such expenditures, as well as expenditures on police, garbage removal and maintenance of roads and lawns, was vital. He feared that the retrenchment committee would cripple the fair for once and for all. Holmes, newly free and land rich, brought a new woman to the fair, Georgiana Yoke, whom he had met earlier in the year at a department store, Schlesinger and Meyer, where she worked as a saleswoman. She had grown up in Franklin, Indiana, and lived there with her parents until 1891, when she set out for a bigger, more glamorous life in Chicago. She was only 23 when she met Holmes, but her small size and sun-blonde hair made her look much younger, almost like a child, save for the sharp features of her face and the intelligence that inhabited her very large blue eyes. She had never met anyone like Holmes. He was handsome, articulate, and clearly well off. He even possessed property in Europe. She felt a certain sadness for him, however. He was so alone. All his family was dead, save one aunt living in Africa. His last uncle had just died and left him a large fortune comprised of property in the South and in Fort Worth, Texas. Holmes asked her to be his wife. She agreed instantly. He cautioned, however, that for the marriage he would have to use a different name, Henry Mansfield Howard. It was his dead uncle's name, he said. The uncle was blood-proud and had bequeathed Holmes his estate on condition he first adopt the uncle's name in full. Holmes had obliged, out of respect for his uncle's memory. Mayor Harrison, too, believed he was in love, with a New Orleans woman named Annie Howard. He was 68, and a widower twice over. She was in her 20s. No one knew exactly where in her 20s, but estimates put her between 21 and 27 years old. She was very plump, by one account, and full of life. She had come to Chicago for the duration of the fair and was renting a mansion near the mayor's. Harrison and Miss Howard had some news for the city, but the mayor had no plans to reveal it until October 28th, when the exposition would host American Cities Day. His day, really. 2 days before the official close, but the day when he would get to stand before several thousand mayors from around the country and revel in his stature as mayor of Chicago, the city that built the greatest fair of all time. On July 31st, 1893, after 2 investigative hearings, the retrenchment committee gave its report to the exposition's board of directors. The report stated that the financial management of the fair can only be characterized as shamefully extravagant. Drastic cuts in spending and staff were necessary immediately. The retrenchment committee made it clear that at least for its 3 members, the financial success of the fair was as important as its obvious aesthetic success. The honor of Chicago's leading men, who prided themselves on their unsentimental, some might say ruthless, pursuit of maximum profit, was in peril. The report closed, "If we are not to be disgraced before the public as businessmen, this matter must be followed up sharply and decisively." In separate statements, the retrenchment committee urged the directors to make the committee permanent and invest it with the power to approve or deny every expenditure at the exposition, no matter how small. This was too much, even for the equally hardened businessmen of the exposition board. Harlow N. Higginbotham, who by now had replaced William Baker as president of the exposition, said he would resign before he would cede such power to anyone. Other directors felt likewise. Stung by this rejection, the three men of the retrenchment committee themselves resigned. The retrenchers' report had been too harsh, too much a rebuke, at a time when the mood throughout Chicago was one of sustained exultation at the fact that the fair had gotten built at all, and that it had proven more beautiful than anyone had imagined. None of the exposition directors or officers had any illusions, however. The rate of paid admissions had to be increased still more, and soon. Only 3 months remained until the closing ceremony on October 30th. The closure was supposed to happen at the end of October, meaning October 31st, but some unidentified crafter of the federal legislation erred in thinking October had only 30 days. Frank Millett, meanwhile, stepped up his efforts to promote the fair and arranged an increasingly exotic series of events. His big coup was the Great Midway Ball, held on the night of Wednesday, August 16th. The ball took place at the fair's natatorium, a large building on the Midway devoted to swimming and bathing, and equipped with a ballroom and banquet rooms. The galleries that overlooked the ballroom were outfitted with opera boxes for fair officials and socially prominent families. It was hot. Chief Rain in the Face, the Sioux chief who had killed Custer's brother and now occupied Sitting Bull's cabin in the Midway, wore green paint that streamed down his face. A Laplander wore a fur shirt. Eskimo women wore blouses of walrus skin. The Tribune, in an unintended parody of its own penchant for describing the gowns of the rich, noted that Lola, a South Sea Islander, wore her native costume of bark cloth covering about half the body with low-cut and sleeveless bodice. As the night wore on and the wine flowed, the line to dance with Lola grew long. Sadly, the belly dancers came in robes and turbans. Men in black dress suits circled the floor, swinging black Amazons with bushy hair and teeth necklaces. Chicago, and perhaps the world, had never seen anything like it. The Tribune called the ball the strangest gathering since the destruction of the Tower of Babel. The ball and Frank Millett's other inventions imparted to the exposition a wilder, happier air. The exposition by day might wear a chaste gown of white staff, but at night it danced barefoot and guzzled champagne. Attendance rose. The daily average of paid admissions for August was 113,403, at last topping the vital 100,000 threshold. The margin was slim, however, and the nation's economic depression was growing steadily worse, its labor situation more volatile. On August 30th, 25,000 unemployed workers converged on the downtown lakefront and heard Samuel Gompers, standing at the back of Speaker's Wagon No. 5, ask, "Why should the wealth of the country be stored in banks and elevators, while the idle workman wanders homeless about the streets, and the idle loafers who hoard the gold only to spend it in riotous living are rolling about in fine carriages from which they look out on peaceful meetings and call them riots?" For the city's industrialists and merchant princes who learned of Gomper's speech in their Sunday morning newspapers, this was a particularly unsettling question, for it seemed to embody a demand for much more than simply work. Gompers was calling for fundamental change in the relationship between workers and their overseers. This was dangerous talk, to be suppressed at all costs. It was exciting, this prospect of becoming one of the city's most important officials. At last, Prendergast could leave behind the cold mornings and filthy streets and the angry newsboys who disobeyed him and taunted him. He was growing impatient, however. His appointment as corporation counsel should have occurred by now. One afternoon in the first week of October, Prendergast took a grip car to City Hall to see his future office. He found a clerk and introduced himself. Incredibly, the clerk did not recognize his name. When Prendergast explained that Mayor Harrison planned to make him the city's new corporation counsel, the clerk laughed. Prendergast insisted on seeing the current counsel, a man named Krauss. Certainly Krauss would recognize his name. The clerk went to get him. Krauss emerged from his office and extended his hand. He introduced Prendergast to the other men on his staff as his successor. Suddenly, everyone was smiling. At first, Prendergast thought the smiling was an acknowledgement that soon he would be in charge. But now he saw it as something else. Krauss asked if he'd like the position immediately. "No," Prendergast said. "I am in no hurry about it," which was not true. But the question had thrown Prendergast. He did not like the way Krauss asked it. Not at all. Later, an alienist named Daniel R. Brower, former superintendent of the Eastern Lunatic Asylum, would testify that Krauss had erred in humoring Prendergast. By doing so, Dr. Brower said, Krauss had intensified Prendergast's delusion. By 10 o'clock in the morning on Monday, October 8, 1893, the day Frank Millet had designated as Chicago Day, ticket takers at the fair's 64th Street gate made an informal count of the morning's sales thus far and found that this one gate had recorded 60,000 paid admissions. The men knew from experience that on any ordinary day, sales at this gate accounted for about one-fifth the total for any given time, and so came up with an estimate that some 300,000 paid visitors already had entered Jackson Park, more than any other full day's total, and close to the world's record of 397,000 held by the Paris Exposition. Yet the morning had barely begun. The ticket takers sensed that something odd was happening. The pace of admission seemed to be multiplying by the hour. In some ticket booths, the volume grew so great, so quickly, that silver coin began piling on the floors and burying the ticket takers' shoes. Millet and other fair officials had expected high attendance. Chicago was proud of its fair, and everyone knew that only 3 weeks remained before it would close forever. To assure maximum attendance, Mayor Harrison had signed an official proclamation that urged every business to suspend operation for the day. The courts closed, as did the Board of Trade. The weather helped, too. Monday was an apple-crisp day, with temperatures that never exceeded 62 degrees under vivid cerulean skies. Every hotel had filled to capacity, even beyond capacity, with some managers finding themselves compelled to install cots in the lobbies and halls. George Ferris, riding his wheel that day, looked down and gasped, "There must be a million people down there." Ferris had nearly gotten it right. In that single day, 713,646 people had paid to enter Jackson Park. Only 31,059, 4%, were children. Another 37,380 visitors entered using passes and brought the total admission for the day to 751,026, more people than had attended any single day of any peaceable event in history. The Tribune argued that the only greater gathering was the massing of Xerxes' army of over 5 million souls in the 5th century B.C. The Paris record of 397,000 had indeed been shattered. When the news reached Burnham's shanty, there were cheers and champagne and stories through the night. But the best news came the next day, when officials of the World's Columbian Exposition Company, whose boasts had been ridiculed far and wide, presented a check for $1.5 million to the Illinois Trust and Savings Company, and thereby extinguished the last of the exposition's debts. The Windy City had prevailed.